to reach this point, the part Taylor generating function. So this is an object that contains all the information about a huge number of amplitudes, but it's still not enough. As we discussed, all we can get from here are amplitudes where we have two negative helicity gluons and the rest pluses. And together with those, we also discovered that we found many, many other amplitudes where the particles could be fermions or could be scalars, but again, only a very small subset of all the possibilities that are out there. In particular, we want to go for amplitudes. So let me introduce here a number k that tells us the number of negative helicity gluons that you can get out of this formula. And in this case, these amplitudes have k equals to 2. And we want to go to sectors where we have k different from 2, 3, or higher. We know that when k is equal to 1 or k is equal to 0, the amplitudes are 0, except when we have 3 particles and k is equal to 1, and we allow for complex momenta where the amplitudes could be taken to be non-zero. Now, yesterday I promised that we were going to fix that problem in just 5 minutes or 10 minutes. If you have the right ideas, or you have Witten as your friend, you can solve the problem very easily. And here is the idea. Said, well, actually, as we said in the first lecture, Nair, in 1988, realized that this formula could be thought of as a formula that can be obtained from mapping a sphere into a bigger space. For the time being, I'm going to write just a small space, which is also going to be a sphere. The reason is the following. We discuss how the SL2C action works on the spinors lambda. And SL2C acts on these spinors in a way that it would act on a complex projective space, meaning on the way it would act on a sphere. Okay? So Nair's idea was that perhaps these spinors we're actually living in some space and that just like in a string theory, we should have another sphere with some particular coordinates that maps into this other sphere. So here we have two variables and here we also need two variables. Why am I introducing a scale and then a variable here? The reason is the following. So what I'm drawing there is the project, is the stereographic coordinate on the sphere of a given point. So this point is sigma A. And the point that touches the plane is here. This is the south pole and this is the north pole. But you know very well that if you cover the plane with this patch, you're going to miss the north pole, right? So how do you cover the North Pole? Well, you will have to put now your plane on top of the sphere and use a different stereographic projection so that the North Pole sits at the origin. And this will give you another set of coordinates, sigma a hat. And that's achieved by rescalings in TA. So you rescale TA so that you set this equal to 1. And now the coordinate sigma hat sits here. And this rescaling allows you to go from one patch to another. Okay? So mathematicians, instead of thinking about these coordinates, they prefer to think about two complex numbers that you are allowed to have and rescale arbitrarily. And when you have that, they call the space a complex projective space. Okay? So that's what we're going to do. So Nair had the idea of connecting lambda A1 and 2 to this auxiliary sphere. So how can we do this at the level of the formula? Well, one way would be to connect these two things by enforcing that they are the same. So we are supposed to integrate over all possibilities for these coordinates and impose that this happens. Well, we would like to insert this constraint into our part-Taylor generating function. But if we want to insert it without changing the formula, we have to make sure that this is equal to 1. Is it equal to 1 now? Not quite. We're missing something to make it equal to 1. You see what this means? Well, let me write it more explicitly. These are two delta functions. The first one says that the first component of this has to agree with TA, and the second component has to agree with this. We want to insert 1 into the part-Taylor formula, but this, with this measure, is not quite equal to 1. But you see that if I put a TA here, since I'm integrating over TA, this is the same as d TA sigma A, and the integral is trivially equal to 1, okay? Very good. Now we're ready. So we can rewrite the part-Taylor formula in a way that it starts to look more like a string theory, an integration over punctures or points on a CP1 that are mapped into some space. So let's again write our formula in the way that we have found by just introducing this object for every particle. So we're going to have the product from A1 to N, d sigma A, TA, d sigma TA for every particle. We also have the constraint. For every particle, we want to have that this is true. And then we just copy our formula. But of course, now we can use this new formula for every one of the lambdas that we see over there. So the first delta function will look like this. I'm going to split it and make it look as follows. This is the top component of the first formula. The bottom component, remember that 2 times 2 means that we have two groups of two delta functions. So this is the top component, the one that corresponds to the top component of lambda. And the other one would be now we have to repeat the same thing for the supersymmetric part that has the etas. OK, for the time being, let's just say that this is the eta part. Is this clear? So this came from, I think it would be nice to have the, yes, here it is. And we can mix the two styles of talks. So these two delta functions are the ones that come from here by applying that on this support. We can replace lambda by this. What else do we have to change? We have to change the denominator. So let's write it here. So every time you have AB, this is the determinant of lambda A, lambda B. And if we are on the support of the delta function, this becomes nothing but TA times TB times sigma A minus sigma B. Now we're going to apply that to the denominator of the formula. And what do we get? So you see that for every time that a particle index appears, we're going to get a TA. So we get the product over all the TAs squared times the difference of all the sigmas. OK, that's starting to look good. Now let's take this part and put it here. So this is a product as well over every one. So we could simply remove this and cancel one power and put one power in the denominator. So I'm gonna do it. And this is starting to look very, very nice. I mean, it depends. If you like string theory, it's starting to look nice. It's starting to look like an integral over points on a sphere that are mapped into some space with some particular integrand. But it's still not satisfactory. Why is it not satisfactory? If you were doing a string theory, so let me do it here, it's not satisfactory. So what's the one thing that you're always happy to do when you're doing a string theory integral? Or as you saw in quantum field theory 3, if you have an SL2C action that you're supposed to have on a sphere, what is the first thing that you do with that SL2C action? If you're giving a bunch of points there, what is the thing that you want to do with an SL2C action? And I know you saw that in quantum field theory 3.
Fix some of them?
You can fix some of them. How many of them?
Three.
You can fix three of them to whatever you want. Can you do that here? Well, if you could, I wouldn't say that it's not satisfactory. So the answer is no. We don't have. Any SL2C. Freedom on the sigma here. So this is still not an integral over points on a CP1. So we have to fix that problem. How can we fix that problem? Well, the key is to realize that this thing, let me write it like this. It's as if somehow, instead of fixing three sigmas, we had fixed something here to be 1, 0, 0, 1. Rather than fixing three points on the sphere, we ended up fixing three or four coordinates of the way the sphere is mapped into the sphere of the lambdas. So if we reinstate those degrees of freedom, maybe we can recover the SL2C invariance. So that's what we're going to do. So we're going to reinstate those degrees of freedom. So our trick would be to bring back here I'm saying bring back because I'm assuming we're going to get something that has SL2C invariance in the formula so that we can act it on the sigmas. By introducing extra coordinates and writing that delta function for all the lambdas as follows. So instead of having the boring 1, 0 vector, we're going to have a spinor, rho 0. It has two components. And in this formula, somehow, we were fixing this to be 1, 0, and 0, 1. Okay, so you would say, well, if you introduce these integrations, who knows? Maybe it's not possible to introduce a redundancy and get a formula that works. So let's actually do it and see what happens. So let's replace this with the object we have there. So we have A, TA, now we have rho 0 plus rho 1 sigma A. And we are supposed to include as well the integration over rho 0 and rho 1. And hope that this formula looks like the original formula. Except that we want this formula to look like a string theory formula. So what we need, really, is something that has a redundancy so that we can put here the volume of SL to C, and think about this as a more honest string theory formula. Well, let's check. What do we want to check? We want to check that this formula has a redundancy under the action of SL to C that acts the natural way on the sigmas. So what is SL to C acting on the sigmas? Is something that looks like this, where A, B, C, and D form a matrix that has determinant 1. So one of the possibilities, so let's see. Let's see here. So let's recap what the trick is. The original formula that we got straightforwardly from the Part-Taylor generating function was not satisfactory because the sigmas could not be thought of as points on a Riemann sphere. The reason is that if they had been points on a Riemann sphere, you should have had the freedom, the SL to C freedom, to fix them. Having the freedom means that the integral that you have is invariant under that transformation. And the integral we had originally was not. But we realized that parts of the maps that connect the sigmas to the lambdas seem to be frozen to some particular values. So if we unfreeze them, maybe we can bring back the redundancy. And it's as if the redundancy had been used, instead of fixing the sigmas, had been used to fix the maps, had been used to fix these vectors 0, 1, and 1, 0. That all sounds great, but we have to check if it's true. So we brought it back, we put back these rows, and now we want to see whether this formula is invariant under SL to C. And if it is, and the action of SL to C allows us to fix row 0 and row 1 to be 1, 0, and 0, 1, then we're in business, because by gauge fixing with SL to C, we can fix this formula to the original one that we had, but also we could decide not to do it and instead act with SL to C on the sigmas, which would be the standard string theory action. Okay? Very good. So let's check with, say, a translation. So this is the SL to C action that we're going to apply. So what happens to all the sigmas? So the sigmas get shifted by some number B. So is our new formula invariant under that? Well, certainly if we don't do anything on the rows, it's not invariant, right? So clearly, all the denominators go to themselves. So we don't have to worry about them. They are invariant. This part of the formula is invariant. But we have to worry about this part of the formula. Is there any transformation that we can induce on the rows, any change of variables that will render this invariant? Well, I'm sure you all figured it out. If we make this transformation, what do we have to do to row 1, to this spinner? This is something that has two components. Do we have to change it? No? Excellent. About row 0. If you want the formula to be invariant, we have to send row 0 to minus and if we do that, the whole formula is invariant. The measure doesn't pick up any factors, right? The integration measures, these are linear transformations. So the measure, the Jacobian of these transformations is 1. We don't do anything to the TAs. Everything is invariant. This is great. So we only have to check 2 more generators. But I'm not going to do it. You're going to do it, right? Because you are now so excited that you're going to do it. OK, so now we have to really check that if this is true. So we're going to check, say, the rescaling and the special conformal transformations, right? Yes?
What about the elastato function?
Oh, brilliant. Exactly. So we didn't check any of this. This one we don't have to worry about because TA doesn't do anything. What happens to the second delta function? That's the question. So the second delta function goes to itself plus something proportional to the first delta function. It's invariant. All right. Now we're going to be in trouble. All right, excellent. But SL2C has only three generators. And I told you that we were fixing four things here. So we are missing one. We're missing one redundancy. If we are to succeed, we're missing one redundancy. So the extra redundancy of our formula is, and how would you discover it? If you try to evaluate this formula, you will get nonsense. You will get that the Jacobian vanishes. So you will get infinity, which is a sign that there is still a redundancy you haven't fixed. Even after fixing SL2C, you will discover that there is still a GL1, which is also known as a rescaling. And what is that GL1? What do you think it does on the sigma A's? Well, this one better be a different rescaling than the one that sits inside SL2C. SL2C also has a rescaling of the sigmas. So this one better do nothing on the sigmas. It does nothing on the sigmas, but now it does something on the T's, where SL2C didn't do anything. So we have this, I can rescale it by TA. Now you can see that if we do this and we want the delta functions to be invariant, the rows will have to scale with the inverse T, all of them. And you can check that everything works beautifully up to here. So the rescaling will give you everything. Everything will transform covariantly. But you will find that if you only apply that transformation on this part, you will discover that this formula is not invariant. It picks some factor of that rescaling T. That would be very, very annoying. We were so close to getting a formula that works. Well, who fixes that? These guys. These guys are exactly right to fix the rescaling. So how can we make that manifest in the formula? One way to do it, and as you know, I like very much to introduce different fonts when you're writing on the blackboard. So I'm going to introduce yet another one. So let me do the following. So you see that the delta functions, they look identical on the top there for the lambdas. And the lambda tildes and the eta tildes, they appear exactly in the same way. So what if we introduce the following notation? Let's call this object a super object, meaning it's just a six-dimensional object that has the two components of the lambda tilde and the four components of I. So these are two, and these are four. So it's a six-dimensional object that lives in a strange space because two of the components are bosonic, and two and four of the components are fermionic. But this is just a slick notation in order to erase this SUSY from here and put them here. And the way I'm going to remember that this dimensionality is as funny two dimensions that are bosonic and four that are fermionic, this is the standard way of doing it. So this is bosonic, and these ones are fermionic. So don't be amused by the notation. It's just notation. This means that you have six delta functions. Two of the delta functions contain these two components, and four of the delta functions contain these components, just like what we have there. Now we can check the rescaling if you want. So we can check the rescaling by saying, well, if we rescale this, this is invariant. There is nothing here. How many factors we have here? We get t to the minus 4, because we said that t is scaled as an inverse. There is nothing here. That's how it was defined. So how many guys we have here? These guys don't transform, right? The sigmas were not transforming. Now what happens to these guys? So this guy will transform and produce a factor of t for every bosonic, and a factor of 1 over t for every bosonic, and a factor of t for every fermionic one. So these guys here will produce this one will produce a t squared, and the next one will produce a t squared, canceling the t to the minus 4 that came from the measure. All right. That means that we can complete this by saying that the whole redundancy was this form. OK? So now, having defined an object that is consistent, we can take our SL2C and think that it acts on the sigmas in the same way that it does in string theory, and fix 3 of the sigmas to any value, 0, 1, and infinity, or whatever value that you want. So this formula is the first example of a formula that you will get from a string theory. So this is very, very close to a string theory formula. So being close doesn't mean there is a string theory underlying, that there is a string theory underlying this, but it seems that we're very close. OK, but now written in this form is where you call Witten and ask, well, is there any way of generalizing this thing? We know that this works for particles that have helicity 2. Two guys have helicity minus 2, and the rest have helicity plus. So do you know any geometry or anything that can help us generalize this? Then he would come and say, well, what you have here is a very special case where your sphere that you have over there, the sigma sphere, covers the lambda sphere once. So for every point here, as you move and cover this sphere, the connection that we made that is over there covers this sphere once. And that's called a map of degree 1. So this is called the degree. But he would tell you that those are the simplest possible ones. Mathematicians, or well, anyone really, but mostly mathematicians, would like to consider more general maps where you can actually go around the original sphere and cover the other one more than once. You'd say, well, there are maps of degree 2, and so on, degree 3, 4, and so on. And you say, well, that sounds great, but why don't you tell us how to write them? And they say, well, you almost have the answer there. So you said, this guy, the first case, ended up mapping the spinor A to this, or the sigmas to this. So he would say, well, if you want to get every time you cover the sigma space once, you want to get this guy twice, what you have to do is to increase the order of this polynomial so that you have a quadratic equation. But nothing stops you from going all the way to any degree that you want. OK. You say, well, fine, so let's do it. So what do we have to do to modify this formula? Well, what we have to do is to introduce, well, we still have this volume of SL to C cross GL1 that we shouldn't forget, which was also here. Now we are supposed to integrate over all possible maps, over all possible coefficients that allow us to map the sigma sphere into the lambda sphere. We still have this integration. These delta functions are easy to modify. How about this? How would you modify this? Well, definitely you wouldn't do anything to this. So let's just write it. So you had one of these delta functions for every one of the coefficients that we had here. One for this one, and one for the next one, Ta times sigma A. But now you have D of them. Well, it's natural then to have as many of them as we need. And it turns out that that's the answer to the problem. That computes all possible amplitudes at tree level that you want in Super-Jahn-Mills theory, including the ones that are purely including gluons, that purely include gluons, and that people thought that would be impossible to write down, not even on a book. And now they are written down on a single line. So now we don't have to think about Park Taylor anymore. We have a super fancy generalization of it. So this formula was originally introduced by Witten, and then it was studied, and many of the consistency checks of the formula were done by Reuben, Spratling, and Volovich in 2004. So the formula was introduced in 2003 by Witten. And that's why the formula is usually known as the Witten RSV formula. So when you hear Witten RSV formula, that's what they mean, that form. All right. So is that formula useful for actual calculations? I mean, it looks beautiful. Is it actually useful if you want to get a number? Well, what's the data? The data are these lambdas and the lambda tildes. That's what your experimentalist friends will give you, right? The external particles, as we wrote over there, they will give you the left-hand side. So they will give you the lambdas and the lambda tildes, and they will ask you to compute the number. Well, of course, it's not a number. It's a distribution, because it has momentum conservation. But if you remove momentum conservation, you're supposed to give them back a number after you project to the corresponding amplitude that they want. So you can project out the corresponding amplitude that you want. You have the numbers, and you are asked to pull out momentum conservation and get the scattering amplitude for them. Well, there is good news and bad news. What do you want first? Okay, the bad news. Oh, no. Well, well, the bad news is that you have to solve these polynomial equations. And these are equations where the degree of the polynomials that you have to solve increases depending on the number, well, which I didn't tell you, the number of negative Felicity gluons that your experimentalist friend has or that they want you to compute. So k, as I said, is the number of negative Felicity gluons, and it's related to d by this formula. So d is k minus 2, sorry, k minus 1. So in the Park-Taylor case, you had two negative Felicity gluons, so the degree of the map is 1, and that I can do. But if you have three negative Felicity particles, the degree of the map is 2, now you have to solve quadratic equations. Well, that I can do too. That's fine. But you have many of them, so that's a problem. So even that would be a little bit tricky when the number of particles gets very large. But as the number of negative Felicity particles increases, the degree increases, and it turns out that the number of solutions that you will find to this system is the following. It's something that you can find in Wikipedia, if you haven't seen before. You just type Eulerian numbers, and you will find something like this. For the number of particles n, well, that's not what you're going to find. So you're going to find Eulerian numbers. And if you plug n, the number of particles, into this formula, and k, the number of negative Felicity particles here, you will find a number that they list. OK, that's all pretty good. But maybe these numbers are not that big. Well, it turns out that if you sum from k equals to 2, sorry, from k, yes, to 2 to n minus 2, these numbers, at least some of them will have to be very big, because this sum is known, is very well known to be n minus 3 factorial. So people who do combinatorics think about these numbers as the way of splitting the permutation of n minus 3 elements by the number of ascents that you have to make as you go in the permutation, if you drew the permutation on an axis, so from 1 to n, and here from 1 to n, and you drew the permutation by putting dots where each of these points go. So the number of times that you go up, you don't count the number of times that you go down, only the number of times that you go up. That number of permutations, if you fix that number to be k minus 2, this will be the number of such permutations. And of course, if you sum over all possibilities, you get the total number of permutations. So that's the bad news. And what's the good news? The good news is that this formula, even though it doesn't seem to be very practical, in fact, for practical calculations, you already know what to do. What would you use if you want to compute something and get an answer? There is something you were taught, how actually it was the only thing we used to prove something. We did it yesterday. For practical computations, use the BCFW recursion relations. So why did we bother to do all this? Well, that's the good news. So this formula allows us to prove general properties of amplitudes, which would be very hard to prove otherwise. So let's quickly have a look at one of those properties. How is this called?
Pancalegro.
Exactly. And sometimes, your quantum field theories, we have a very special property that happens to enhance this symmetry group to something larger. Have you ever seen it?
Conformal
symmetry. Sometimes your quantum field theories will have conformal invariants enhancing the Poincaré group. So this guy has 10 generators, right? It has 6 plus 4, and it goes to 15. So these 10 generators in our spinor notation the Lorentz generators can be written like this. Remember, now we have SL2C. So SL2C will give us 3 generators here and 3 generators here, in the sense that we have to split them into real generators. So we have 3 plus 3. And the other 4 are the momentum, which we know how to write. It's just lambda alpha dot. How do we enhance that? So this is 10 plus 5, and 5 is 4 plus 1. So what is this one? It's a new thing that not all theories have, which are dilatations. And these 4 correspond to a vector that are the special conformal transformations. And this guy, in this spinor notation, turns out to be a second-order differential operator. Now, what if I told you that that formula is invariant under this whole symmetry group? And I tell you, well, go and check it. Well, OK. So it looks a little daunting. But maybe. So as I promised, that formula is supposed to allow us to make things manifest that were not manifest in the original formulation, or just using BCFW. So how can we make this manifest? Could there be any way? Well, one clue is to realize that SO2,4 at the level of the algebra is isomorphic to SL4. So this is something that acts as 4x4 matrices that act on a 4-dimensional space. Wouldn't it be nice if we could write that formula in a way such that this SL4 action was manifest, was something acting on a 4-dimensional object? Well, here we have a 2-dimensional object and another 2-dimensional one, but they seem to appear in the formula in such different way that there is no hope they can combine to produce something nice so that SL4 will act and mix them up. But the clue is here. And this is where, again, Witten comes. And he says, well, these generators, this is looking like that because these generators don't look very nice. After all, they are supposed to be part of this SL4 transformation, so they better look more or less the same in order to have a chance to make the symmetry manifest. So to turn them into something that looks more or less the same, this is a zero-order differential operator. And this is a second-order differential operator. What if we try to turn both of them, bring them from 0 and 2 to just first-order differential operators? So how can we do that? Well, he proposed to do a Fourier transform in just the lambda tildes. In other words, replace this by a conjugate variable. If you do that, what happens? Well, P in this new formulation goes to a first order differential operator. What happens to K? Goes to what? Well, this part stays. But this means that this thing is also the derivative of the lambda. So we can replace that by this one. So now both of them look like first, they are first order differential operators. And if you check, the dilatation operator and the Lorentz transformations will also become first order differential operators. So they should act linearly on whatever object they act on, written in these variables. And that will give us a chance of making this manifest. So what do we have to do? We have to perform the Fourier transform of this formula with respect to the lambda tildes. That sounds complicated, but it's actually not. It's not that complicated. Let's keep our fancy definition of these lambdas here. So the new formulation, new space, is going to be the space of lambdas and mu's, which are the Fourier transform of the lambda tildes. So we are supposed to take our formula and produce a new formula, the Fourier transform, but with respect to the lambda tildes. So we are supposed to integrate over all possible lambda tildes. And this is just to be fancy. I'm going to put here, I'm going to correlate the lambda with the lambda of component one with the mu component two. And the way I'm going to do it is by putting the square bracket that anticorrelates the indices. But it's just for convenience. It's not really that important. So let's do that and put this guy in. All right? You see what I'm doing? I want to compute the Fourier transform of this whole object, of this monster, with respect to lambda tildes, only lambda tildes. Well, in order to do that, every time you see the Fourier transform of something where the variable that you want to Fourier transform only appears in a delta function, what's the nicest thing to do? Well, you could write this as an integral itself. So let me do it. Again, we have two. I'm not going to worry about the supersymmetric part. We will fix that later. We could do everything supersymmetrically from the get-go. But let's just worry about the bosonic part. So I'm going to write this delta function over the two bosonic parts like this times I gamma m. Now this is contracted. This is a spinner. And it's contracted with this whole thing. Sum over ta sigma a to the d, or to the m. Oh, somebody should have told me there is a typo in this formula. What is the typo? Yeah, you're allowed to. Yes.
The exponent of the sigma should be m rather than?
Yes, thank you. Do you agree? This is a product from m equals to 0 to d. All right. So each one of these delta functions becomes that. And that's the only place where lambda tilde enters in our formula. Now we can carry out the integration over the lambda tilde. It's completely trivial. It's just in the exponential. So we can collect everything that has lambda tilde a in it. So let's do it. So collect all lambda tilde a dependence And what do you find? So every degree will contribute one term to the lambda tilde A. So for a particular A, so you will find that you will have an integral over lambda tilde A, e to the, so let's collect this with mu A. So there will be lambda tilde A here. Sorry. So let's put lambda tilde A here. There will be mu A coming from here. So let's write that. This guy gives rise to this. This is a matter of convention. Let me put a minus sign here. No, actually it's correct. Yes, let's leave it like that. It's fine. So we have that. Now if we pick the factor of lambda A from there, we're going to get something that looks like minus. From the first term, we're going to get TA gamma 0. The second one will give T1 sigma A up to TD sigma A to the D. So every one of these delta functions will contribute one thing that is proportional to lambda tilde A. And what is proportional to lambda tilde A is gamma M times TA times sigma A to the M. So this is what we collect from all these delta functions. Is that clear? Yes?
Can you clarify again why you're pairing the exponents in this anti-symmetric fashion?
Yes. Just because I want to keep the SL2C transformations in a nice way. So I want this guy to transform in the same way under SL2C as this one, so that the exponent is invariant. It's just convention for what the mu's are, right? So I'm saying that the conjugate of this guy is mu 1 with the index up. But if I write the mu with the index down, I'll have to use the epsilon tensor to put it down. So it's just a way of making the transformation under SL2C consistent. So I have to correlate this guy with mu 2 with the index down, and lambda tilde 2 with mu 1. All right. So is this step clear? All I'm doing is collecting everything from here that will depend on lambda tilde A, a particular A, because I want to perform the integral. So what would this integral give? I know why you're asking now, because you're wondering what that integral gives you. So that integral looks like this. It's integral lambda tilde A1 e to the I lambda tilde A1 with the second component of a whole mess that appears there. Times the same thing for lambda tilde 2 A e to the I lambda 2 tilde A and a whole bunch of factors. No matter what this is, what is this integral? What does it give? It's a delta function of whatever thing we have here. So this object is nothing but the delta function of this thing here. But this is a spinner, so it has two components coming from the two integrals that I wrote down there. So you have delta 2 of mu a minus ta gamma 0 gamma 1 sigma a plus gamma d sigma a to the d. Now, you see, just by chance, completely by chance, look at this delta function and look at this delta function. Isn't that amusing? And that's how it happens. So you're working on your calculations, and then all of a sudden, the two formulas appear on the same page, and you say, could it be? Now there is no lambda tilde anymore. all we have is mu. That's our new data. And lambda. And what were we looking for? We were looking for a four-component object to make conformal symmetry manifest, the SL4 manifest. But lambdas and lambda tildes could not be put together because they look very, very different in the formula. Now, after the Fourier transform, we realize that lambdas and mu's are both two-component objects, but now they enter the formula in exactly the same way. So they really want to be put together as pieces of a bigger thing. Let's actually use this blackboard now. So the conclusion is that lambda A and mu A want to combine. They are begging you to combine them into a single thing. So what would be the single thing they want to combine into? Well, it's a four-component object. So now this is something that lives in C4, not in C2 and C2, but in C4. And we can give a name to this. Let's call it ZA. Now let's write down our formula in terms of this ZA. So this formula, the Fourier transform of the original formula, is still 1 over the volume of SL to C cross GL1. Well, who else wants to be combined into a single object? Well, if you're willing to combine lambda with mu into a single object, we might want to combine rho and gamma into a single object, rho 1 and gamma 1 into a single object, and so on. So let's actually do it. Let's introduce a single object for them. Why not? And then when we perform the integrations, we perform the integrations over a four-dimensional object. Of what? Of still our product over all the sigmas, the t's. How about the delta functions? Now the delta functions look like this. One for each particle that tells us that this four-component object has to be equal to the combination of these objects. Divided by the difference of the sigmas. All right. But we still have something left to do, which is that we didn't bother to write anything with the etas. Well, but by now you should know what I'm about to do. What I'm about to do is to abuse notation again and say that instead of integrating and performing the Fourier transform on just the lambda tildes, I'm going to do it on the whole object. And yesterday we saw what the Fourier transform of a Grassmann variable is. It's exactly the same. We just integrate over the Grassmann variable, e to the I, the Grassmann variable, times. So we can also introduce the Fourier transform variable of this, which would be something we can call, we can give another definition, something like eta this would be the Fourier transform with respect to, sorry, we're integrating over these ones. So whatever function of these eta tildes we had, we can integrate over them and introduce another Grassmann variable, and that would be our Fourier transform. But it's clear that we can do it exactly in the same way as we did it for the lambdas. So we can do this slash 2, put here and put here, do the same thing here, and supersymmetrize all these integrations. And at the end of the day, our formula will just tell us that we have something that looks supersymmetric here. So the Z's will grow 4 more components. For the maps, well, let's denote these ones as sky. And these guys will also grow 4 more components, which are the etas. And this space will turn into C4/4, 4 bosonic components, 4 fermionic components. And these integrals will look like this. It's amazing. That's all I had to do there. Oh, it's because I'm forgetting. Am I forgetting anything? Oh, yes. I'm forgetting to tell you how many delta functions we have. So we had 4 bosonic, but now we also have these ones, 4 fermionic. So this space you can check that if you choose these ZAs or you choose anything that is proportional to them, this formula is invariant under that. So the space of kinematic invariance is not the full space of C4/4, but it's a space of points here modeled out by this relation, where this is a non-zero complex number. And this space is known as a complex projective space, CP3, with 4 fermionic directions. And CP3 is what Penrose identified as the space of null rays in Minkowski space, or in a space time. These ZAs are called twisters. And this now looks like a formula for a string theory where you map your worksheet into this big space, which is twister space. So if there was such a string theory that maps the sphere into twister space, how would you call it? So this would be called, if such a thing existed, twister string theory. So does it actually exist? Well, it turns out the answer to that question is still not completely known. You can write down a model, a two-dimensional conformal field theory that lives on this space, whose target space is this space. There is even a string theory that naturally lives on that space. It's called the topological B model. But the problem was that the moment you try to generalize all this to loop level, you run into trouble. So let's end the lecture by listing some questions. So is there really a full string theory? Whose correlation functions give the full perturbative S matrix of n equals 4 super young meals. And we still don't know the answer to that question. So why is the question so difficult? We did three levels. Well, three level in string theory corresponds to integrating over a sphere with points on the sphere. How about one loop? That's the next thing you would try. What are you supposed to integrate over? Over the maps, not from the sphere to the space, but from the torus to the space. But this, as Oliver is going to tell us in 2 weeks, produces elliptic functions. But elliptic functions are the wrong space of functions for quantum field theory. So already, from the very beginning, we seem to be into trouble. If we have a full string theory that integrates over genus 1 Riemann surfaces, there is no escape to produce elliptic functions. But elliptic functions are the wrong kind of functions to describe quantum field theory amplitudes, luckily. Well, it depends if you like elliptic functions. Finally, so even if we just think about three level, what's the connection, or what's the origin between this sphere and the space of kinematic invariance given by solving those equations? Moreover, is all this simply a consequence of dealing with a super special theory, which is called n equals 4 super young meals? We know this theory is the one that is dual to string theory and ADS, CFT, and ADS. It's a super conformal field theory. It has the maximum number of supersymmetries. And I'm sure there are tons of other things that are special about this that we still don't know and that will be discovered at some point. So the formula that I wrote down there is the formula that computes the full three-level S matrix of this theory. The question is, have we spent all these 4 lectures, these 4 days of your life, just writing down the formula for a very super special theory? And it cannot be generalized to any other theories. Well, the good news is that, of course, no, it can be generalized. And that's what we're going to do tomorrow. All right? OK, so we can stop here.